Blackstone Audio presents The Illustrated Man by Ray Bradbury. To Henry Kuttner, with my grateful thanks for his help and encouragement on this book. Dancing So as Not to Be Dead, an introduction by Ray Bradbury. My waiter friend, Laurent, working at the Brasserie Champ du Mar near the Eiffel Tower one night while serving me une grande bière, explained his life. I work from 10 to 12 hours, sometimes 14, he says, and then at midnight I go dancing until 4 or 5 in the morning, and go to bed and sleep until 10, and then up and to work by 11, and another 10 or 12 or sometimes 15 hours of work. How can you do that? I ask. Easily, he says. To be asleep is to be dead. It is like death. So if we dance so as not to be dead. We do not want that. How old are you? I ask at last. 23, he says. Ah, I say, and take his elbow gently. Ah, 23, is it? 23, he says, smiling. And you? 76, I say. And I do not want to be dead, either. But I am not 23. How can I answer? What do I do? Yes, says Laurent, still smiling and innocent. What do you do at 3 in the morning? Right, I say, at last. Right? Laurent says, astonished. Right? So as not to be dead, I say. Like you. Me? Yes, I say, smiling now myself. At 3 in the morning I write. You are very lucky, says Laurent. You are very young. So far, I say, and finish my beer and go up to my typewriter to finish a story. What then is my choreography to outwit death? In story after story, the illustrated man hid metaphors aching to explode. In most cases, I don't even know the metaphors lay waiting to be printed off my retina. We theorize about what goes on in the brain, but it is mostly undiscovered country. A writer's work is to coax the stuff out and see how it plays. Surprise, as I have often said, is everything. Take Kaleidoscope, for instance. I decided one morning, 46 years ago, to explode a rocket and toss my astronauts out into a wilderness of space to see what would happen. The result was a story that was reprinted in countless anthologies and appeared and reappeared in high school and college auditoriums. Students across country performed the story in class to teach me once again that theater doesn't need sets, lights, costumes, or sound. Just actors in school or in someone's garage or storefront speaking the lines and sensing the passion. Shakespeare's bare stage still stays as prime example. Watching the kids act the dark territory of Kaleidoscope on a bright summer afternoon in San Fernando Valley decided me to write and stage my own version. How do you cram 1,000,000 miles of interplanetary flight onto a stage 40 feet wide and 20 deep before an audience of 99? You just do it. And when the last human meteor fires down the sky, there's not a dry eye in the house. All space, time, and the heartbeats of 7 men are trapped in the words which, when spoken, set them free. What if is the operative term for many of these stories. What if you landed on a far world the day after Christ had just left to go elsewhere? Or what if he were still there, waiting, hence the man? What if you could create a world within a room that 40 years later would be dubbed the first virtual reality and introduced a family to that room where its walls might operate on their psyches and deliver forth nightmares? I built the room on my typewriter and let my family prowl. By noon, the lions had leaped off the walls and my children were having tea at the finale. What if a man could order a marionette robot that was his exact clone? What would happen if he left it with his wife while he went out nights? Marionettes, Inc. What if all your favorite childhood authors hid out on Mars because their books were being burned on Earth? The Exiles. The start of more fires I would light with books 3 years later, Fahrenheit 451. What if the colored people, that's what they were called when I wrote The Other Foot in 1949, arrived on Mars first, put down roots, built towns, and prepared to welcome the whites when they arrived? What would happen next? I wrote the story to find out. Then I couldn't find an American magazine that would buy the story. It was long before the Civil Rights Movement. The Cold War was starting up. And the House Un-American Committee was holding hearings, headed by Parnell Thomas. Joseph McCarthy arrived later. In such an atmosphere, no editor wanted to land on Mars with my dark immigrants. I finally gave The Other Foot to New Story, a Paris-based magazine edited by Martha Foley's son, David. And again, what if you had an acre of junk in your backyard? Would you be tempted to weld it together and take a journey to the moon? There was just such a junkyard 40 feet behind my house in Tucson, Arizona, when I was 12. There I made lunar trips on late afternoons and then ran to a locomotive elephant's graveyard 2 blocks away, where I climbed up in abandoned steam engines to whistle-stop my way to Kankakee, Oswego, and Far Rockaway. Between the junkyard rocket and the long-lost locomotives, I was never home. Thus, the rocket. The what-ifs ricocheted around in my head. In other words, the left side of my brain, if there is a left side, proposed. The right side of my brain, if there is a right side, disposed. No use proposing on the left if there is no one home on the right. I was lucky in my genetics. God, the cosmos, the life force, whatever fits, gave me the right side as ball catcher for anything the stuff from the left field pitched over the plate. One half, the left, seems obvious. The other half, the right, stays mysterious, daring you to fetch it out in the light. The seance, which is to say the typewriter, computer, pen, pencil, and paper, are there to catch the ghosts before they thin out in midair. Cut the comedy, my father would grouch. What do you mean in plain English? What I'm trying to say is that the creative process is much like the old-fashioned way of taking photos with a huge camera, and you horsing around under a black cloth seeking pictures in the dark. The subjects might not have stood still. There might have been too much light, or not enough. One can only fumble, but fumble quickly, hoping for a developed snap. These, then, are developed snaps, roused at dawn, posed at breakfast, and finalized by noon. All with no finales at 10 a.m., all with happy or unhappy endings just after lunch or with weak coffee and strong brandy at 4. Taking a chance on love, as one old song put it. Or in the words of Mel Brooks' 12 Chairs song, hope for the best, expect the worst. You could be Tolstoy or Fanny Hurst. I hoped for H.G. Wells or to share company with Jules Verne. When I worked out a living space between the two, I was ecstatic. I end as I began, with my Parisian waiter friend Laurent, dancing all night, dancing, dancing. My tunes and numbers are here. They have filled my years, the years when I refused to die. And in order to do that, I wrote, I wrote, I wrote at noon or 3 a.m. so as not to be dead. Prologue. The Illustrated Man. It was a warm afternoon in early September when I first met the Illustrated Man. Walking along an asphalt road, I was on the final leg of a 2 weeks' walking tour of Wisconsin. Late in the afternoon I stopped, ate some pork, beans, and a doughnut, and was preparing to stretch out and read when the illustrated man walked over the hill and stood for a moment against the sky. I didn't know he was illustrated then. I only knew that he was tall, once well-muscled, but now, for some reason, going to fat. I recall that his arms were long, and the hands thick, but that his face was like a child's, set upon a massive body. He seemed only to sense my presence, for he didn't look directly at me when he spoke his first words.
"Do you know where I can find a job?"
"I'm afraid not," I said.
"I haven't had a job that's lasted in 40 years, he said.
Though it was a hot late afternoon, he wore his wool shirt buttoned tight about his neck. His sleeves were rolled and buttoned down over his thick wrists. Perspiration was streaming from his face, yet he made no move to open his shirt.
"Well," he said at last, "this is as good a place as any to spend the night. Do you mind company?"
"I have some extra food you'd be welcome to," I said. He sat down heavily, grunting.
"You'll be sorry you asked me to stay," he said. "Everyone always is. That's why I'm walking. Here it is, early September, the cream of the Labor Day carnival season. I should be making money hand over fist at any small-town sideshow celebration, but here I am with no prospects."
He took off an immense shoe and peered at it closely.
"I usually keep a job about 10 days. Then something happens and they fire me. But now every carnival in America won't touch me with a 10-foot pole.
"What seems to be the trouble?" I asked. For answer, he unbuttoned his tight collar slowly. With his eyes shut, he put a slow hand to the task of unbuttoning his shirt all the way down. He slipped his fingers in to feel his chest.
"Funny," he said, eyes still shut. "Can't feel them, but they're there. I always hope that someday I'll look and they'll be gone. I walk in the sun for hours on the hottest days, baking, and hope that my sweat'll wash them off, the sun'll cook them off, but at sundown they're still there."
He turned his head slightly toward me and exposed his chest.
"Are they still there now?"
After a long while, I exhaled.
"Yes," I said. "They're still there. The illustrations."
"Another reason I keep my collar buttoned up," he said, opening his eyes, "is the children. They follow me along country roads. Everyone wants to see the pictures, and yet nobody wants to see them."
He took his shirt off and wadded it in his hands. He was covered with illustrations from the blue tattooed ring about his neck to his belt line.
"It keeps right on going," he said, guessing my thought. "All of me is illustrated. Look."
He opened his hand. On his palm was a rose freshly cut, with drops of crystal water among the soft pink petals. I put my hand out to touch it, but it was only an illustration. As for the rest of him, I cannot say how I sat and stared, for he was a riot of rockets and fountains and people, in such intricate detail and color that you could hear the voices murmuring, small and muted, from the crowds that inhabited his body. When his flesh twitched, the tiny mouths flickered, the tiny green and gold eyes winked, the tiny pink hands gestured. There were yellow meadows and blue rivers and mountains and stars and suns and planets spread in a milky way across his chest. The people themselves were in 20 or more odd groups upon his arms, shoulders, back, sides, and wrists, as well as on the flat of his stomach. You found them in forests of hair, lurking among a constellation of freckles, or peering from armpit caverns, diamond eyes aglitter. Each seemed intent upon his own activity. Each was a separate gallery portrait.
"Why, they're beautiful," I said.
How can I explain about his illustrations? If El Greco had painted miniatures in his prime, no bigger than your hand, infinitely detailed, with all his sulphurous color, elongation, and anatomy, perhaps he might have used this man's body for his art. The colors burned in three dimensions. They were windows looking in upon fiery reality. Here, gathered on one wall, were all the finest scenes in the universe. The man was a walking treasure gallery. This wasn't the work of a cheap carnival tattoo man with three colors and whiskey on his breath. This was the accomplishment of a living genius, vibrant, clear, and beautiful.
"Oh, yes," said the illustrated man. "I'm so proud of my illustrations that I'd like to burn them off. I've tried sandpaper, acid, a knife."
The sun was setting, the moon was already up in the east.
"For you see," said the illustrated man, "these illustrations predict the future."
I said nothing.
"It's all right in sunlight," he went on. "I could keep a carnival day job, but at night, the pictures move. The pictures change."
I must have smiled. "How long have you been illustrated?"
"In 1900, when I was 20 years old and working a carnival, I broke my leg. It laid me up. I had to do something to keep my hand in, so I decided to get tattooed."
"But who tattooed you? What happened to the artist?"
"She went back to the future," he said. "I mean it. She was an old woman in a little house in the middle of Wisconsin, here somewhere not far from this place. A little old witch who looked 1,000 years old one moment and 20 years old the next, but she said she could travel in time." I laughed. Now I know better.
"How did you happen to meet her?" He told me. He had seen her painted sign by the road, "Skin Illustration." Illustration instead of tattoo. Artistic. So he had sat all night while her magic needles stung him wasp stings and delicate bee stings. By morning he looked like a man who had fallen into a 20-color print press and been squeezed out, all bright and picturesque.
"I've hunted every summer for 50 years, he said,
putting his hands out on the air.
"When I find that witch, I'm going to kill her."
The sun was gone. Now the first stars were shining and the moon had brightened the fields of grass and wheat. Still, the illustrated man's pictures glowed like charcoals in the half-light, like scattered rubies and emeralds, with Rouault colors and Picasso colors and the long, pressed-out El Greco bodies.
"So people fire me when my pictures move. They don't like it when violent things happen in my illustrations. Each illustration is a little story. If you watch them, in a few minutes they'll tell you a tale. In 3 hours of looking, you could see 18 or 20 stories acted right on my body. You could hear voices and think thoughts. It's all here, just waiting for you to look. But most of all, there's a special spot on my body.
He bared his back.
See? There's no special design on my right shoulder blade. Just a jumble.
Yes.
When I've been around a person long enough, that spot clouds over and fills in. If I'm with a woman, her picture comes there on my back in an hour and shows her whole life. How she'll live. How she'll die. What she'll look like when she's 60. And if it's a man, an hour later his picture's here on my back. It shows him falling off a cliff or dying under a train. So I'm fired again.
All the time he had been talking, his hands had wandered over the illustrations, as if to adjust their frames, to brush away dust, the motions of a connoisseur, an art patron. Now he lay back, long and full in the moonlight. It was a warm night. There was no breeze, and the air was stifling. We both had our shirts off.
And you've never found the old woman?
Never.
And you think she came from the future?
How else could she know these stories she painted on me?
He shut his eyes tiredly. His voice grew fainter.
Sometimes at night I can feel them. The pictures. Like ants. Crawling on my skin. Then I know they're doing what they have to do. I never look at them anymore. I just try to rest. I don't sleep much. Don't you look at them either, I warn you. Turn the other way when you sleep.
I lay back a few feet from him. He didn't seem violent, and the pictures were beautiful. Otherwise I might have been tempted to get out and away from such babbling. But the illustrations. I let my eyes fill up on them. Any person would go a little mad with such things upon his body. The night was serene. I could hear the illustrated man's breathing in the moonlight. Crickets were stirring gently in the distant ravines. I lay with my body sideways so I could watch the illustrations. Perhaps half an hour passed. Whether the illustrated man slept, I could not tell, but suddenly I heard him whisper,
"They're moving, aren't they?" I waited a minute. Then I said,
"Yes." The pictures were moving, each in its turn, each for a brief minute or two. There in the moonlight, with the tiny, tinkling thoughts and the distant sea voices, it seemed each little drama was enacted. Whether it took an hour or 3 hours for the dramas to finish, it would be hard to say. I only know that I lay fascinated and did not move while the stars wheeled in the sky. 18 illustrations, 18 tales. I counted them one by one. Primarily, my eyes focused upon a scene, a large house with two people in it. I saw a flight of vultures on a blazing flesh sky. I saw yellow lions, and I heard voices. The first illustration quivered and came to life.
The Veldt.
George, I wish you'd look at the nursery.
What's wrong with it?
I don't know.
Well, then,
I just want you to look at it is all, or call a psychologist in to look at it.
What would a psychologist want with a nursery?
You know very well what he'd want. His wife paused in the middle of the kitchen and watched the stove busy humming to itself, making supper for four. It's just that the nursery is different now than it was.
All right, let's have a look.
They walked down the hall of their soundproofed, happy life home, which had cost them $30,000 installed. This house, which
clothed and fed and rocked them to sleep, and played and sang and was good to them. Their approach sensitized a switch somewhere, and the nursery light flicked on when they came within 10 feet of it. Similarly, behind them in the halls, lights went on and off as they left them behind, with a soft automaticity. "Well?" said George Hadley. They stood on the thatched floor of the nursery. It was 40 feet across by 40 feet long and 30 feet high. It had cost half again as much as the rest of the house. "But nothing's too good for our children," George had said. The nursery was silent. It was empty as a jungle glade at hot high noon. The walls were blank and two-dimensional. Now, as George and Lydia Hadley stood in the center of the room, the walls began to purr and recede into crystalline distance, it seemed, and presently an African veldt appeared, in 3 dimensions, on all sides, in colors reproduced to the final pebble and bit of straw. The ceiling above them became a deep sky with a hot, yellow sun. George Hadley felt the perspiration start on his brow. "Let's get out of the sun," he said. "This is a little too real. But I don't see anything wrong."
"Wait a moment, you'll see," said his wife.
Now the hidden odor of phonics were beginning to blow a wind of odor at the two people in the middle of the baked veldtland. The hot straw smell of lion grass, the cool green smell of the hidden waterhole, the great rusty smell of animals, the smell of dust like a red paprika in the hot air. And now the sounds, the thump of distant antelope feet on grassy sod, the papery rustling of vultures. A shadow passed through the sky. The shadow flickered on George Hadley's upturned, sweating face.
"Filthy creatures," he heard his wife say.
"The vultures.
You see, there are the lions. Far over, that way. Now they're on their way to the water hole." "They've just been eating," said Lydia. "I don't know what."
"Some animal." George Hadley put his hand up to shield off the burning light from his squinted eyes. "A zebra or a baby giraffe, maybe."
"Are you sure?"
His wife sounded peculiarly tense. "No, it's a little late to be sure," he said, amused. "Nothing over there I can see but cleaned bone, and the vultures dropping for what's left."
"Did you hear that scream?" she asked.
"No."
"About a minute ago?"
"Sorry, no." The lions were coming, and again George Hadley was filled with admiration for the mechanical genius who had conceived this room. A miracle of efficiency selling for an absurdly low price. Every home should have one. Oh, occasionally they frightened you with their clinical accuracy. They startled you, gave you a twinge. But most of the time, what fun for everyone, not only your own son and daughter, but for yourself when you felt like a quick jaunt to a foreign land, a quick change of scenery. Well, here it was. And here were the lions now, 15 feet away, so real, so feverishly and startlingly real that you could feel the prickling fur on your hand, and your mouth was stuffed with the dusty upholstery smell of their heated pelts, and the yellow of them was in your eyes like the yellow of an exquisite French tapestry, the yellows of lions and summer grass, and the sound of the matted lion lungs exhaling on the silent noontide, and the smell of meat from the panting, dripping mouths. The lions stood looking at George and Lydia Hadley with terrible green-yellow eyes.
"Watch out!" screamed Lydia.
The lions came running at them. Lydia bolted and ran. Instinctively, George sprang after her. Outside in the hall, with the door slammed, he was laughing and she was crying, and they both stood appalled at the other's reaction.
"George!"
"Lydia! Oh, my dear, poor, sweet Lydia!"
"They almost got us!"
Walls, Lydia, remember? Crystal walls, that's all they are. Oh, they look real, I must admit. Africa in your parlor. But it's all dimensional superactionary, supersensitive color film and mental tape film behind glass screens. It's all odorophonics and sonics, Lydia. Here's my handkerchief.
I'm afraid.
She came to him and put her body against him and cried steadily.
Did you see? Did you feel? It's too real.
Now, Lydia,
you've got to tell Wendy and Peter not to read any more on Africa.
Of course, of course. He patted her.
Promise.
Sure.
And lock the nursery for a few days until I get my nerves settled.
You know how difficult Peter is about that. When I punished him a month ago by locking the nursery for even a few hours, the tantrum he threw, and Wendy too, they live for the nursery.
It's got to be locked. That's all there is to it.
All right. Reluctantly, he locked the huge door. You've been working too hard. You need a rest.
I don't know. I don't know, she said,
blowing her nose, sitting down in a chair that immediately began to rock and comfort her.
Maybe I don't have enough to do. Maybe I have time to think too much. Why don't we shut the whole house off for a few days and take a vacation?
You mean you want to fry my eggs for me?
Yes,
she nodded. And darn my socks?
Yes,
a frantic, watery-eyed nodding. And sweep the house?
Yes, yes, oh, yes!
But I thought that's why we bought this house, so we wouldn't have to do anything.
That's just it. I feel like I don't belong here. The house is wife and mother now, and nursemaid. Can I compete with an African veld? Can I give a bath and scrub the children as efficiently or quickly as the automatic scrub bath can? I cannot. And it isn't just me. It's you. You've been awfully nervous lately.
I suppose I have been smoking too much.
You look as if you didn't know what to do with yourself in this house either. You smoke a little more every morning, and drink a little more every afternoon, and need a little more sedative every night. You're beginning to feel unnecessary, too.
Am I? He paused, and tried to feel into himself to see what was really there.
Oh, George!
She looked beyond him, at the nursery door.
Those lions can't get out of there, can they?
He looked at the door and saw it tremble as if something had jumped against it from the other side.
Of course not, he said.
At dinner they ate alone, for Wendy and Peter were at a special plastic carnival across town and had televised home to say they'd be late, to go ahead eating. So George Hadley, bemused, sat watching the dining room table produce warm dishes of food from its mechanical interior.
We forgot the ketchup, he said.
Sorry,
said a small voice within the table, and ketchup appeared. As for the nursery, thought George Hadley, it won't hurt for the children to be locked out of it a while. Too much of anything isn't good for anyone, and it was clearly indicated that the children had been spending a little too much time on Africa. That sun! He could feel it on his neck still, like a hot paw. And the lions! And the smell of blood! Remarkable how the nursery caught the telepathic emanations of the children's minds and created life to fill their every desire. The children thought lions, and there were lions. The children thought zebras, and there were zebras. Sun, sun. Giraffes, giraffes. Death and death. That last. He chewed tastelessly on the meat that the table had cut for him. Death thoughts. They were awfully young, Wendy and Peter, for death thoughts. Or, no, you were never too young, really. Long before you knew what death was, you were wishing it on someone else. When you were 2 years old, you were shooting people with cap pistols. But this,
the long, hot African belt, the awful death in the jaws of a lion, and repeated again and again. "Where are you going?" He didn't answer Lydia. Preoccupied, he let the lights glow softly on ahead of him, extinguish behind him as he padded to the nursery door. He listened against it. Far away, a lion roared. He unlocked the door and opened it. Just before he stepped inside, he heard a faraway scream, and then another roar from the lions, which subsided quickly. He stepped into Africa. How many times in the last year had he opened this door and found Wonderland, Alice, the Mock Turtle, or Aladdin and his magical lamp, or Jack Pumpkinhead of Oz, or Dr. Doolittle, or the cow jumping over a very real appearing moon, all the delightful contraptions of a make-believe world. How often had he seen Pegasus flying in the sky ceiling, or seen fountains of red fireworks, or heard angel voices singing. But now this yellow, hot Africa, this bake oven with murder in the heat. Perhaps Lydia was right. Perhaps they needed a little vacation from the fantasy which was growing a bit too real for 10-year-old children. It was all right to exercise one's mind with gymnastic fantasies, but when the lively child mind settled on one pattern, it seemed that, at a distance, for the past month, he had heard lions roaring and smelled their strong odor seeping as far away as his study door. But, being busy, he had paid it no attention. George Hadley stood on the African grassland alone. The lions looked up from their feeding, watching him. The only flaw to the illusion was the open door through which he could see his wife, far down the dark hall, like a framed picture, eating her dinner abstractedly. "Go away," he said to the lions. They did not go. He knew the principle of the room exactly. You sent out your thoughts. Whatever you thought would appear. "Let's have Aladdin and his lamp," he snapped. The Veldland remained. The lions remained. "Come on, room. I demand Aladdin," he said. Nothing happened. The lions mumbled in their baked pelts. "Aladdin!" He went back to dinner. "The full room's out of order," he said. "It won't respond."
Or
what?
"Or it can't respond," said Lydia. "Because the children have thought about Africa and lions and killing so many days that the room's in a rut."
"Could be."
"Or Peter said it to remain that way."
"Said it?"
"He may have got into the machinery and fixed something."
"Peter doesn't know machinery.
He's a wise one for 10. That IQ of his..."
"Nevertheless."
"Hello, Mom. Hello, Dad."
The Hadleys turned. Wendy and Peter were coming in the front door, cheeks like peppermint candy, eyes like bright blue agate marbles, a smell of ozone on their jumpers from their trip in the helicopter.
"You're just in time for supper," said both parents.
"We're full of strawberry ice cream and hot dogs," said the children, holding hands. "But we'll sit and watch."
"Yes. Come tell us about the nursery," said George Hadley.
The brother and sister blinked at him, and then at each other.
"Nursery?"
"All about Africa and everything," said the father with false joviality.
"I don't understand," said Peter.
"Your mother and I were just traveling through Africa with rod and reel. Tom Swift and his electric lion," said George Hadley.
"There's no Africa in the nursery," said Peter simply.
"Oh, come now, Peter. We know better."
"I don't remember any Africa," said Peter to Wendy.
"Do you?"
"No."
"Run see and come tell." She obeyed.
"Wendy, come back here," said George Hadley, but she was gone.
The house lights followed her like a flock of fireflies. Too late, he realized he had forgotten to lock the nursery door after his last inspection.
"Wendy'll look and come tell us," said Peter. She doesn't have to tell me, I've seen it.
I'm sure you're mistaken, Father.
I'm not, Peter. Come along now. But Wendy was back.
It's not Africa, she said breathlessly.
We'll see about this, said George Hadley, and they all walked down the hall together and opened the nursery door. There was a green, lovely forest, a lovely river, a purple mountain, high voices singing, and Rima, lovely and mysterious, lurking in the trees with colorful flights of butterflies like animated bouquets, lingering in her long hair. The African Veltland was gone. The lions were gone. Only Rima was here now, singing a song so beautiful that it brought tears to your eyes. George Hadley looked in at the changed scene.
Go to bed, he said to the children.
They opened their mouths. You heard me, he said. They went off to the air closet, where a wind sucked them like brown leaves up the flue to their slumber rooms. George Hadley walked through the singing glade and picked up something that lay in the corner near where the lions had been. He walked slowly back to his wife.
What is that? She asked.
An old wallet of mine, he said.
He showed it to her. The smell of hot grass was on it, and the smell of a lion. There were drops of saliva on it. It had been chewed, and there were blood smears on both sides. He closed the nursery door and locked it tight. In the middle of the night, he was still awake, and he knew his wife was awake.
Do you think Wendy changed it? She said at last in the dark room.
Of course.
Made it from a veld into a forest, and put Rima there instead of lions?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know. But it's staying locked until I find out.
How did your wallet get there?
I don't know anything, he said. Except that I'm beginning to be sorry we bought that room for the children. If children are neurotic at all, a room like that,
it's supposed to help them work off their neuroses in a healthful way.
I'm starting to wonder.
He stared at the ceiling.
We've given the children everything they ever wanted. Is this our reward? Secrecy? Disobedience?
Who was it said children are carpets they should be stepped on occasionally? We've never lifted a hand. They're insufferable, let's admit it. They come and go when they like. They treat us as if we were offspring. They're spoiled, and we're spoiled.
They've been acting funny ever since you forbade them to take the rocket to New York a few months ago.
They're not old enough to do that alone, I explained.
Nevertheless, I've noticed they've been decidedly cool toward us since.
I think I'll have David McLean come tomorrow morning to have a look at Africa.
But it's not Africa now. It's Green Mansions country and Rima.
I have a feeling it'll be Africa again before then.
A moment later they heard the screams. Two screams. Two people screaming from downstairs. And then a roar of lions.
Wendy and Peter aren't in their rooms, said his wife.
He lay in his bed with his beating heart.
No, he said. They've broken into the nursery.
Those screams? They sound familiar.
Do they?
Yes, awfully.
And although their beds tried very hard, the two adults couldn't be rocked to sleep for another hour. A smell of cats was in the night air.
Father, said Peter.
Yes?
Peter looked at his shoes. He never looked at his father anymore, nor at his mother.
You aren't going to lock up the nursery for good, are you?
That all depends.
On what? Snapped Peter.
On you and your sister. If you intersperse this Africa with a little variety, oh, Sweden perhaps, or Denmark, or China,
I thought we were free to play as we wished.
You are,
within reasonable bounds.
What's wrong with Africa, Father?
Oh, so now you admit you have been conjuring up Africa, do you?
I wouldn't want the nursery locked up, said Peter coldly. Ever.
Matter of fact, we're thinking of turning the whole house off for about a month. Live sort of a carefree, one-for-all existence.
That sounds dreadful. But I have to tie my own shoes instead of letting the shoe tire do it, and brush my own teeth, and comb my hair, and give myself a bath.
It would be fun for a change, don't you think?
No. It would be horrid. I didn't like it when you took out the picture painter last month.
That's because I wanted you to learn to paint all by yourself, son.
I don't want to do anything but look and listen and smell. What else is there to do?
All right. Go play in Africa.
Will you shut off the house sometime soon?
We're considering it.
I don't think you'd better consider it anymore, Father.
I won't have any threats from my son.
Very well.
And Peter strolled off to the nursery.
Am I on time? Said David McLean.
Breakfast? Asked George Hadley.
Thanks, had some. What's the trouble?
David, you're a psychologist.
I should hope so.
Well, then, have a look at our nursery. You saw it a year ago when you dropped by. Did you notice anything peculiar about it then?
Can't say I did. The usual violence is a tendency toward a slight paranoia here or there. Usual in children because they feel persecuted by parents constantly, but, oh, really nothing.
They walked down the hall.
I locked the nursery up, explained the father, and the children broke back into it during the night. I let them stay so they could form the patterns for you to see.
There was a terrible screaming from the nursery.
There it is, said George Hadley. See what you make of it.
They walked in on the children without rapping. The screams had faded. The lions were feeding.
Run outside a moment, children, said George Hadley. No, don't change the mental combination. Leave the walls as they are. Get!
With the children gone, the two men stood studying the lions clustered at a distance, eating with great relish whatever it was they had caught.
I wish I knew what it was, said George Hadley. Sometimes I can almost see. Do you think if I brought high-powered binoculars here and...
David McLean laughed dryly.
Hardly.
He turned to study all four walls.
How long has this been going on?
A little over a month.
It certainly doesn't feel good.
I want facts, not feelings.
My dear George, a psychologist never saw a fact in his life. He only hears about feelings, vague things. This doesn't feel good, I tell you. Trust my hunches and my instincts. I have a nose for something bad. This is very bad. My advice to you is to have the whole damn room torn down and your children brought to me every day during the next year for treatment.
Is it that bad?
I'm afraid so. One of the original uses of these nurseries was so that we could study the patterns left on the walls by the child's mind, study at our leisure, and help the child. In this case, however, the room has become a channel toward destructive thoughts instead of a release away from them.
Didn't you sense this before?
I sensed only that you had spoiled your children more than most, and now you're letting them down in some way.
What way?
I wouldn't let them go to New York.
What else?
I've taken a few machines from the house and threatened them a month ago with closing up the nursery unless they did their homework. I did close it for a few days to show I meant business. Aha! Does that mean anything? Everything. Where before they had a Santa Claus, now they have a Scrooge. Children prefer Santa. You've let this room and this house replace you and your wife and your children's affections. This room is their mother and father, far more important in their lives than their real parents. And now you come along and want to shut it off. No wonder there's hatred here. You can feel it coming out of the sky. Feel that sun. George, you'll have to change your life. Like too many others, you've built it around creature comforts. Why, you'd starve tomorrow if something went wrong in your kitchen. You wouldn't know how to tap an egg. Nevertheless, turn everything off. Start new. It'll take time. But we'll make good children out of bad in a year. Wait and see. But won't the shock be too much for the children? Shutting the room up abruptly for good? I don't want them going any deeper into this, that's all. The lions were finished with their red feast. The lions were standing on the edge of the clearing, watching the two men. Now I'm feeling persecuted, said McLean. Let's get out of here. I never have cared for these damned rooms. Make me nervous. The lions look real, don't they? Said George Hadley. I don't suppose there's any way... What? That they could become real? Not that I know. Some flaw in the machinery. A tampering or something. No. They went to the door. I don't imagine the room will like being turned off, said the father. Nothing ever likes to die, even a room. I wonder if it hates me for wanting to switch it off. Paranoia is thick around here today, said David McLean. You can follow it like a spore. Hello? He bent and picked up a bloody scarf. This yours? No, George Hadley's face was rigid. It belongs to Lydia. They went to the fuse box together and threw the switch that killed the nursery. The two children were in hysterics. They screamed and pranced and threw things. They yelled and sobbed and swore and jumped at the furniture. You can't do that to the nursery, you can't! Now, children! The children flung themselves onto a couch weeping. George, said Lydia Hadley, turn on the nursery. Just for a few moments. You can't be so abrupt. No. You can't be so cruel. Lydia, it's off, and it stays off. And the whole damn house dies as of here and now. The more I see of the mess we've put ourselves in, the more it sickens me. We've been contemplating our mechanical electronic navels for too long. My God, how we need a breath of honest air. And he marched about the house, turning off the voice clocks, the stoves, the heaters, the shoe shiners, the shoe lacers, the body scrubbers, and swabbers, and massagers, and every other machine he could put his hand to. The house was full of dead bodies, it seemed. It felt like a mechanical cemetery, so silent. None of the humming, hidden energy of machines waiting to function at the tap of a button. Don't let them do it, wailed Peter at the ceiling, as if he was talking to the house, the nursery. Don't let Father kill everything. He turned to his father. Oh, I hate you. Insults won't get you anywhere. I wish you were dead. We were, for a long while. Now we're going to really start living. Instead of being handled and massaged, we're going to live. Wendy was still crying, and Peter joined her again. Just a moment. Just one moment. Just another moment of nursery, they wailed. Oh, George, said the wife. It can't hurt. All right, all right. If they'll only just shut up. 1 minute, mind you, and then off forever. "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy," sang the children, smiling with wet faces.
"And then we're going on a vacation. David McLean is coming back in half an hour to help us move out and get to the airport. I'm going to dress. You turn the nursery on for a minute, Lydia. Just a minute, mind you."
And the three of them went babbling off while he let himself be vacuumed upstairs through the air flue and set about dressing himself. A minute later, Lydia appeared.
"I'll be glad when we get away," she sighed.
"Did you leave them in the nursery?"
"I wanted to dress, too. Oh, that horrid Africa. What can they see in it?"
"Well, in 5 minutes, we'll be on our way to Iowa. Lord, how did we ever get in this house? What prompted us to buy a nightmare?"
"Pride? Money? Foolishness?"
"I think we'd better get downstairs before those kids get engrossed with those damned beasts again." Just then they heard the children calling.
"Daddy! Mommy! Come quick! Quick!"
They went downstairs in the air flue and ran down the hall. The children were nowhere in sight. "Wendy! Peter!" They ran into the nursery. The Veltland was empty save for the lions waiting, looking at them.
"Peter! Wendy!"
The door slammed.
"Wendy! Peter!"
George Hadley and his wife whirled and ran back to the door.
"Open the door!" cried George Hadley, trying the knob.
"Why, they've locked it from the outside!"
"Peter!"
he beat at the door.
"Open up!"
He heard Peter's voice outside, against the door.
"Don't let them switch off the nursery and the house," he was saying.
Mr. and Mrs. George Hadley beat at the door.
"Now don't be ridiculous, children. It's time to go. Mr. McLean will be here in a minute, and—"
And then they heard the sounds. The lions on three sides of them, in the yellow veldt grass, padding through the dry straw, rumbling and roaring in their throats. The lions. Mr. Hadley looked at his wife, and they turned and looked back at the beasts edging slowly forward, crouching, tails stiff. Mr. and Mrs. Hadley screamed, and suddenly they realized why those other screams had sounded familiar.
"Well, here I am," said David McLean in the nursery doorway.
"Oh, hello."
He stared at the two children seated in the center of the open glade, eating a little picnic lunch. Beyond them was the waterhole and the yellow veldtland. Above was the hot sun. He began to perspire.
"Where are your father and mother?"
The children looked up and smiled.
"Oh, they'll be here directly."
"Good. We must get going."
At a distance, Mr. McLean saw the lions fighting and clawing, and then quieting down to feed in silence under the shady trees. He squinted at the lions with his hand up to his eyes. Now the lions were done feeding. They moved to the waterhole to drink. A shadow flickered over Mr. McLean's hot face. Many shadows flickered. The vultures were dropping down the blazing sky.
"A cup of tea?"
asked Wendy in the silence.
The illustrated man shifted in his sleep. He turned, and each time he turned, another picture came to view, coloring his back, his arm, his wrist. He flung a hand over the dry night grass. The fingers uncurled, and there upon his palm another illustration stirred to life. He twisted, and on his chest was an empty space of stars and blackness, deep, deep, and something moving among those stars, something falling in the blackness. Falling, while I watched.
Kaleidoscope.
The first concussion cut the rocket up the side with a giant can opener. The men were thrown into space like a dozen wriggling silver fish. They were scattered into a dark sea, and the ship in a million pieces went on, a meteor swarm seeking a lost sun.
"Barclay! Barclay, where are you?"
The sound of voices calling like lost children on a cold night.
"Wood! Wood! Captain!
Hollis! Hollis! This is Stone! Stone, this is Hollis. Where are you?"
"I don't know! How can I? Which way is up? I'm falling! Good God, I'm falling!"
They fell. They fell as pebbles fall down wells. They were scattered as jackstones are scattered from a gigantic throw. And now, instead of men, there were only voices, all kinds of voices, disembodied and impassioned, in varying degrees of terror and resignation.
"We're going away from each other!"
This was true. Hollis, swinging head over heels, knew this was true. He knew it with a vague acceptance. They were parting to go their separate ways, and nothing could bring them back. They were wearing their sealed-tight spacesuits, with the glass tubes over their pale faces. But they hadn't had time to lock on their force units. With them, they could be small lifeboats in space, saving themselves, saving others, collecting together, finding each other, until they were an island of men with some plan, but without the force units snapped to their shoulders. They were meteors, senseless, each going to a separate and irrevocable fate. A period of perhaps 10 minutes elapsed while the first terror died, and a metallic calm took its place. Space began to weave its strange voices in and out, on a great dark loom, crossing, recrossing, making a final pattern.
"Stone to Hollis. How long can we talk by phone?"
"It depends on how fast you're going your way, and I'm going mine."
"An hour I make it?"
"That should do it," said Hollis, abstracted and quiet. "What happened?" said Hollis a minute later.
"The rocket blew up, that's all. Rockets do blow up."
"Which way are you going?"
"It looks like I'll hit the moon."
"It's Earth for me. Back to old Mother Earth at 10,000 miles per hour. I'll burn like a match." Hollis thought of it with a queer abstraction of mind. He seemed to be removed from his body, watching it fall down and down through space, as objective as he had been in regard to the first falling snowflakes of a winter season long gone. The others were silent, thinking of the destiny that had brought them to this. Falling